how generalized contextuality is a necessary resource for universal quantum computation. This result was obtained by myself and some collaborators, Haoxing, John, and Matt, and it builds on a lot of preliminaries that I'm also going to be talking about in this talk, derived with also other collaborators like Rob, Ravi, and Ellie, I think all of whom are at this conference. So feel free to hit any of us up with questions afterwards if you have any. So let me start the talk with a puzzle. So the puzzle is the following. Gross's discrete Wigner representation has been very useful in studying quantum computation. And I'll just give a short list of examples of this. So the Gottesman-Knill theorem, for example, can be extended to all processes that are represented non-negatively in Gross's representation. Moreover, every state which is useful for magic state distillation has negativity in this particular representation. And it follows from this result that every state that promotes the stabilizer subtheory to universal quantum computation via magic state distillation has to have Kokenspecker contextuality. And therefore that negativity in Gross's representation is a necessary resource for computation. So many, in fact, I think all of these results were shown by some of the folks at IQC. And there's many other results as well connecting Gross's Wigner representation with quantum computation. And this is a bit of a puzzle because it's kind of well known, at least in the foundations community, that negativity in one particular quasi-probability representation is not generally sufficient to establish non-classicality in any rigorous sense. Because even if one particular representation goes negative, well, there's a huge variety of possible quasi-probability representations, and maybe somebody else will come along and find another one, which is everywhere positive, and that will then constitute a kind of classical explanation. So you can't usually just check one particular representation, but here we find that actually negativity in just one representation, namely Gross's, is associated with a strong form of non-classicality, universal quantum computation. And so that's a bit of a puzzle, but by the end of this talk, I'm gonna explain away that puzzle by showing that Gross's, in fact, is the unique positive quasi-probability representation of the stabilizer subtheory. Equivalently, it's the unique classical or non-contextual representation of the stabilizer subtheory. So our result can be kind of schematized as follows. We're gonna prove a mathematical relationship between generalized contextuality and negativity in Gross's representation. And then using the known connections between Gross's representation having negativity and quantum computation, we can form a kind of bridge to connect generalized contextuality with computation. And this is all analogous to what was done in the well-known paper by Howard et al. In Nature 2014, Contextuality Supplies the Magic for Quantum Computation. They derived a mathematical connection between Kokenspecker contextuality and negativity in Gross's representation, and then used these known connections to form, again, a connection between Kokenspecker contextuality and computation. So we're gonna do the same thing, but for generalized contextuality. And there's a sense in which generalized contextuality is much more natural in the study of quantum computation because it's defined for entire theories and for arbitrary circuits and experiments, whereas Kokenspecker contextuality is really just about the structure of measurements. Okay, so some preliminaries first. First, we have the notion of a process theory. So this is just a very broad kind of theory. Any sort of theory that's closed under composition is gonna fit in the framework of process theories. So these have some collection of systems and a collection of processes on those systems, gates or channels, if you like, on those systems, which are closed under composition. So quantum theory could be viewed as a process theory, or classical theory, or electrical circuits, or you know, a wide range of things could be viewed as a process theory. We'll see some examples in this talk. And once you have some process theories, it's interesting to think about maps between process theories. And in particular, we want these maps to have a feature which we'll call diagram preservation. So a diagram preserving map from one process theory G to another, G prime, takes processes within this first theory to processes in the second, systems in the first theory to systems in the second. So for example, here we have a process F in G, which takes a system S to a system T. Under the action of this map, you get a new process, eta of F, in the new process theory G prime, which takes you from a system in the representation to another system in the representation. So here we've represented the systems and the process in the new theory G prime. And what it means for such a map to be diagram preserving is that it commutes, the representation map commutes with composition. So if you first compose two processes in the domain of the map and then you represent, you get the same thing as if you first represented those things in the codomain and then composed them within the codomain. And if you have this nice property of diagram preservation, then there's a nice diagrammatic notation you can introduce to kind of capture it. So here, instead of just writing the action of the map as follows, I'm going to depict the action of the map as overlaying this green shaded box on the process to be represented. So here you can see by overlaying this thing, we effectively get a new box here, this green box, whose outputs are in the second process theory, G prime, just as the outputs of this box here were in the second process theory. But you can kind of see what the map is being applied to. It's being applied to the process F in the original process theory. And the reason this is a good notation is because you can see it's kind of manifestly diagram preserving. So if I apply the representation map, eta, to some composition of multiple processes, like these three processes that I've wired together in the process theory G, you can see that that's sort of manifestly equal to what you would get if you instead first represented H and F and G individually, and also maybe some identity maps. If you represent those processes individually and then wire them together within the codomain, you can see these two diagrams are manifestly the same if you just kind of stitch the green edges of these boxes together. So it's kind of a convenient representation for us to use for a diagram preserving map. So what does quantum theory look like as a process theory? Well, systems are vector spaces of Hermitian operators on Hilbert space. Processes are just channels on these. Processes which have no inputs are density operators. Processes with no outputs are POVM elements. Composition of channels, composition in this theory is defined as usual, just standard composition of quantum channels. So I can draw circuits and I can compose things together. Here's a circuit with a process with no input being composed with some process with an input and an output, composed with a process with no output. Of course, this is just a quantum state being composed with a quantum channel and a quantum effect. And the composition rule in quantum theory tells us that this object here is just a real number, which is this particular real number. So this is all pretty familiar. Another process theory which is useful to us is the process theory of substochastic matrices, subnormalized matrices, stochastic matrices. So this process theory, the systems are sets, arbitrary sets, and the processes are subnormalized stochastic maps between those sets. And if you have processes that have no inputs, those are probability distributions, which in general can be subnormalized. And processes which have no outputs are things that map probability distributions to real numbers. So they're response functions. Composition in this theory is just matrix multiplication. So if I draw that same kind of circuit, a process with no input, a transformation, and then some process with no output, as I just said, this first process is just a subnormalized probability distribution. So I can denote that like mu of lambda. Composition with some transformation in this process is just matrix multiplication. So I hit it with this matrix and I sum over lambda, that's matrix multiplication. And then composition with the response function is just multiplying by this response function and summing over lambda prime. So this, of course, should all start to look pretty familiar. This is just a classical probability theory. So for example, if you wanted to represent Liouvillean mechanics as a process theory, it would fit naturally in as a substochastic, you could represent it as a sub within this framework of substochastic matrices, because you have some, the set lambda here would be some classical phase space. You have some state of knowledge over it, representing the states of the theory, and then those things evolve stochastically. And so you can represent it in this manner. And a third process theory of interest to us is quasi-substochastic matrices. So the only thing that changes here from substochastic process theory is that we now allow these real numbers in these matrices to go negative. They're no longer all between 0 and 1. And a final process theory, or family of process theories really, is the family of generalized probabilistic theories. So these, I'll say more about what these are later in the talk, but generalized probabilistic theories are possible ways the world could be. So it's kind of a generalization of quantum theory and classical theory, where you can take the systems to be real vector spaces. Processes are just linear maps on the vector space. Processes that have no inputs are just vectors in the space. So those are the states of these theories. Processes that have no outputs are covectors. So again, they take vectors to real numbers, probabilities, in fact. And composition is just defined via the usual composition of linear maps in these theories. So here I have a GPT state being composed with a GPT transformation and a GPT effect. And this composition, using the regular composition of linear maps, just turns into a real number. And an example of a GPT is quantum theory. So this is really a family of process theories that subsumes the other three that I've introduced so far. But it also subsumes many more exotic theories that go beyond quantum theory and have other interesting features. So I'll say a bit more about GPTs to give you some more intuition for them, I guess, on the next slide. So if we focus just on the state and effect spaces of a GPT, people often give the following kind of simple geometric picture, which I think gives a lot of intuition for this kind of family of GPTs. So the state space of a GPT is specified by some convex set of vectors, and the effect space is specified by some other convex set of vectors, which lives in the logical dual of the state space, which means whenever you take a vector in the effect space and you take its inner product with a vector in the state space, you get a number between 0 and 1, so a valid probability. And that probability is interpreted as the probability that that effect would occur in a measurement where it could possibly occur on some on the given state in question. So the inner products between state and effect vectors give you the probabilities of the theory. So then it's clear then that the observable statistics, and hence the entire kind of content of the theory, is just governed by the geometry of the state and the effect spaces. And it might help to think of quantum theory, you know, the block ball, it's the geometry of the block ball together, of course, with the geometry of the effect space in quantum theory that gives you all the characteristic features of a qubit, like, you know, the uncertainty relations that hold for a qubit, for example. And an important feature of these GPTs is that two processes in the GPT are distinct if and only if they give distinct probabilities in at least one circuit. So if I consider states, for example, every two vectors in the space give different probabilities for at least one effect in the space. So in other words, the states and the effects kind of separate each other relative to this inner product. Okay, so that hopefully gives you some intuition for GPTs. For much of this talk, I'll be talking about GPTs as this kind of framework for possible theories. Of course, most of the time, we're interested in the special case of quantum theory. So when I talk about representations of GPTs, you might keep in the back of your mind, representations of quantum theory are a special case of this. But the things that we do apply kind of more broadly, which is nice because then the results we derive don't assume the validity of quantum, the correctness of quantum theory, but they do still apply to it. Okay, so these kinds of ontological, or sorry, the kinds of representations we're interested in, the first kind is an ontological model of a GPT. So the definition of an ontological model of a GPT is a linear diagram preserving map from the GPT into the process theory of substochastic matrices, which I'm calling substock here. So if I give you some GPT channel, then I apply some linear diagram preserving map and I get some substochastic matrix on some sets associated to the two systems in the GPT. And this, any such map that satisfies these two simple properties will be a valid ontologic model of the GPT. So the properties being that when you wire together a bunch of GPT processes, the representation of those in the image, so in substock, will reproduce the same predictions as the GPT. And the representation of the unit effect in the GPT, which is like the trace in quantum theory, is just marginalization in the substochastic theory. So you kind of represent ignoring a system appropriately. And so if you satisfy these properties, it's linear, diagram preserving, reproduces the predictions, and represents ignoring appropriately, then it's an ontological model of the GPT. So for example, if I have some arbitrary GPT circuit, it could be very long and complicated, with many gates and parallel and sequential composition. Here, I just take a simple example that we've seen already, and I'm even taking the special case of quantum theory. I can apply the representation map to it. So here, I'm just representing the entire circuit. Now, by the property of diagram preservation, we can equivalently just represent each individual process in this circuit. And remember, we said, okay, what's the representation of just a quantum state here? Well, it's something in the process theory substock, which has no input, and it has a non-trivial output. So it's just a probability distribution, potentially subnormalized. Similarly, when we take the representation of just a channel in the GPT, it turns into a channel in the in substock, and we get a response function representing the effects in quantum theory. So just using this diagram preservation, we know that this quantity here, which is, you know, it's just a real number in quantum theory, can be represented as a composition of three maps within this ontological model, or within substock, if you like. A second kind of representation that's going to be useful for us is a quasi-probability representation of a GPT. So here, the only thing that changes is the codomain of the map, which is no longer taken to be substock, but rather quasi-substock. So once again, we allow the real values in this matrix representation to go negative. And it's kind of evident then, if this is the only difference between these two kinds of representations, then if it just so happens that for your particular object in your domain, so maybe you consider some simple GPT or maybe some little fragment of quantum theory, if that's your domain and it just so happens that when you map it into quasi-substock via this representation, it's positive everywhere, well, then that representation can just be reinterpreted as a map into substock. So it is just itself an ontological model. So a positive quasi-probability representation is just an ontological model, according to this definition. So there's a simple connection between these two kinds of representations. But the reason this more general kind of representation is useful is because for some GPTs or fragments of GPTs, there is no ontological model. So you can't always find a representation satisfying all of these constraints for a given GPT. It's a non-trivial condition. Whereas you can always find some quasi-probability representation once you allow negativity. There's typically many possible quasi-probability representations for a given GPT. Okay. So we have now these kinds of representations, and we want to ask, when you have such a representation, when should you consider it to be a classical explanation of what's going on? Right? Clearly, it's some kind of simulation. It lets you simulate the statistics of the theory. But is it more than a simulation? Is it really a physical explanation and one that you should consider classical? So I'm not going to spend too long on this, but there's by now a lot of foundational work arguing that the right notion of classicality, the most universally applicable and broadly well-motivated notion of classicality for general operational theories, is generalized non-contextuality. So this can be motivated by Leibniz's principle of the identity of indiscernibles, which is a methodological principle for theory construction that was used very effectively by Einstein and has a nice long history in physics. This notion of generalized non-contextuality is also equivalent to a natural notion of classicality in the quantum optics community. It's equivalent to a natural notion of classicality in the framework of GPTs. And actually, these two points I'm going to continue talking about in this talk. We heard in the previous lecture how in the quantum Darwinist macroscopic limit, non-contextuality emerges naturally, as you would expect for a notion of classicality. It also emerges under sufficient noise and coarse graining. Furthermore, there's a lot of known witnesses of non-classicality, like Koch and Specker contextuality, Bell non-locality, and anomalous weak values, all of which are kind of well-established signatures of non-classicality that imply the failure of generalized non-contextuality. So we kind of subsume those, but generalized non-contextuality is much more broadly applicable as a notion. These particular features only apply for particular causal structures, or in the case of Koch and Specker contextuality, it only applies to the structure of measurements. Generalized non-contextuality can be applied to any theory or any experiment that you like. And finally, this notion of non-classicality is a resource for quantum computation, communication, state discrimination, cloning, metrology. This list is growing longer every day. We find that this is practically a useful way of dividing up phenomena into classical and non-classical. So we say that an unquotiented, for all these reasons, we say that an unquotiented operational theory is classically explainable if and only if it admits of a non-contextual ontological model. And now you're saying, but wait, David, you didn't tell us what an unquotiented operational theory is. And for that matter, you didn't define non-contextuality of an ontological model either. And that's true, although we heard both of these concepts described in Barbara's talk. But here we don't actually need those definitions, because we can prove that from those definitions, there's an equivalent characterization in terms of the concepts that I have already introduced. And that's actually going to be quite useful for us. So in particular, there's a non-contextual ontological model for this arbitrary operational theory here, if and only if the GPT description of that operational theory admits of any ontological model. So if you start with a GPT, you don't have to specify any particular kind of ontological model. You just search if there's any ontological model, If there is one, then you know that you're consistent with the principle of non-contextuality. So that's very convenient for us. In fact, to me, this is one of the most useful results we have in the study of non-contextuality, because these GPTs have a lot of known structure, simple, elegant mathematical structure. They're well studied, whereas unquotiented operational theories are much more kind of abstract and vague concepts that are, they don't have much mathematical structure at all. And so by using this equivalence, we can kind of avoid some of the problems that arise with operational theories, and we can just start with GPTs. And that's quite useful in practice. So I'll just take a one slide detour for the experts in the audience to make this connection a little bit more rigorous. So if you're not super familiar with these notions of operational theories, like what Barbara talked about, hopefully this will still make a bit of sense, but it won't be essential for the rest of the talk. So consider an operational theory and the GPT that you get when you quotient it relative to operational equivalence, that notion that Barbara defined. There's a theorem that there exists a non-contextual ontological model of that operational theory, if and only if there exists any ontological model for the GPT you get when you quotient. And if you're keeping all these definitions in your mind at once, this is actually a quite intuitive theorem. So you have an operational theory, you get the GPT from it by quotienting, which means basically throwing out all the context information, the information that's not relevant to making predictions. And if you can then find an ontological model, so a mapping into substock for that GPT, well then of course just composing the quotienting map with the representation map gives you a map that clearly doesn't depend on context, because the first step in that map is to throw out the context and then represent it. So just take the composition of these two maps to define the non-contextual model of the ontological model. And by construction, it'll have all the relevant features of linearity and not depending on context and diagram preservation. And the converse of this theorem is a little harder to prove, but it's still pretty intuitive. Okay, but the upshot of all this, the only thing we need for this talk, is that if you agree that non-contextuality is a well-motivated notion of non-classicality, of classicality, then within the framework of GPTs, what you should ask is just whether or not there exists an ontological model, and take that as your notion of classicality. So that's what we're going to do for the rest of this talk. And this raises a kind of natural question. Okay, so existence of an ontological model for a GPT, that's what it means to be classical. How does this relate to the sort of traditional notion? GPTs have been studied for a long time, and there's kind of a well-established notion of which GPT is the classical GPT. So traditionally, a GPT is considered classical if it is simplicial, by which I mean that the state space is a simplex. So in dimension three, a simplex would be a triangle formed by these three pure states and then the convex hull of them. And the effect space is the logical dual of the simplex. So the set of vectors whose inner product with these state vectors is a valid probability. And why is this considered a classical GPT? Well, there's a number of kind of simple reasons. So first of all, every state, every point in this state space has a unique decomposition into pure states. And so this is very much unlike quantum theory, right? Where you have many different decompositions of mixed states into pure states. Moreover, you can show that every measurement in this theory is compatible. So there's kind of a single maximally informative measurement that just tells you precisely which state you have. So because of these properties, you can basically imagine that there's a true state of the system, which really is one of these three extremal states. And anytime you assign some mixed state to the system, it's just because you're unsure which of those it really is. And you describe your uncertainty in a unique way by a probability distribution. And we can make this a bit more clear just by adding some kind of suggestive labeling to these systems. So let me add the coordinate system here where I take the vertices of this simplex to be the unit vectors. Well, then it follows that the logical dual is this hypercube here where all of the coordinates of the effect vectors are either zero or one and everything in the convex hull of these. And so now you see that this is just classical probability theory. This is basically just substock where I'm focusing again on just the states and the effects in substock. So here we have, you know, this space of states is just isomorphic to the set of probability distributions over a three-valued set in this case. And here it's just the set of all ways of mapping that into the probabilities. So this is all just kind of a representation of classical probability theory or of substock. And that means if you can find a linear mapping from a GPT into one of these simplicial GPTs, well, that just gives you an ontological model, right? Because if your GPT maps into the simplex, well, then you can just take the point that you map your GPT state to be a probability distribution that's associated to it, its representation in substock. So a GPT admits of an ontological model, if and only if it's linearly embeddable into one of these simplicial GPTs. And now the one little trick here to remember is that it doesn't have to map into a GPT, a simplicial GPT of the same dimension. It might map into some much higher dimensional simplex. And so it can be hard to check, you know, whether you map into some higher dimensional simplex, but at least in principle, it's a well-defined question. And that's the question of existence of an ontological model for a GPT, but now kind of viewed geometrically as a question of, can you map the states and the effects into one of these simplicial GPTs? So at this point now, we've seen four different equivalent notions of classicality. So for a GPT. So in particular, if the operational theory that it came from is non-contextual, we say that it's classical. Equivalently, if that GPT admits of an ontological model, we say it's classical. Or equivalently, if that GPT is simplex embeddable, this is just kind of a geometric reframing of this second point. And a third, the fourth condition we also saw was if there's a positive quasi-probability representation, we said that's sort of trivially just an ontological model. So we have these four different kinds of ways of thinking about classicality of a GPT. And so they're all kind of mutually supportive because they're all equivalent and they kind of have independent intuitions motivating them. And moreover, one or the other of these might be more useful in some particular context. So I mentioned, for example, there's always some quasi-probability representation always exists. So sometimes it can be easier to study those than searching specifically for the ones that are positive, namely the ontological models. And in fact, that's exactly what we're going to do now to make a connection finally to quantum computation. So we're going to use the fact that there's a very strict, rigid mathematical structure to every diagram-preserving quasi-probability representation. And we're going to use that to make connections to non-contextuality now, and then apply that to quantum computation. Okay, so there's a very rigid structure, as I said, for any diagram-preserving quasi-probability representation. Here I'm going to focus on of quantum theory for concreteness. So if you have some quantum systems that you want to represent, for each quantum system, you pick a minimal, so not over complete, basis of trace one Hermitian operators for that system. Then you compute the unique dual basis, by which I mean another set of Hermitian operators, d sub lambda prime, which satisfies this particular condition here relative to the frame operators. And then you represent the states by taking the trace of the state with the dual frame operators. So this, for each lambda, is just a real number. So this is a mapping from a quantum state to a vector of real numbers indexed by lambda. For the effects, you have a similar mapping, but where you trace the effect with the frame elements, not the dual frame elements. So again, this is just a mapping to a vector indexed by lambda. And for transformations, you take the trace of the channel acting on the frame operators with the dual frame operators. And that gives you a stochastic map from lambda to lambda prime. So this is the only possible way of getting a quasi-probability representation for some general systems in quantum theory. And in fact, this doesn't just apply to quantum theory. It extends to all tomographically local GPTs. So this is kind of a very broad class of GPTs, which contains quantum and classical theories, but many others as well. I won't define tomographic locality here for us because we'll just focus on the quantum case. Okay, so this is the only kind of way of constructing a quasi-probability representation of quantum theory, which means if you're looking for positive quasi-probability representations, the only possibility is to look for things of the same form, but where moreover you demand that everything in the image of the map is positive. And then just by remembering that connection to non-contextuality, it moreover follows that every non-contextual ontological model of one of these tomographically local operational theories is also of the same mathematical form, but where you quotient first to get to the GPT. So we have a very rigorous structure now. And just here's one specific feature of that structure. Notice I said at the very start, we begin with a basis, a non-overcomplete basis for the Hermitian operators, which means that you have a very specific number of ontic states here, lambda. The fact that this is a non-overcomplete basis means that the number of ontic states, the number of elements in this frame representation, which remember determines, you know, the dimensionality of these vectors, is just the dimension of the GPT. So if you have like a qubit, for example, the dimension of the GPT, the Hermitian operator space, is 4. And so the number of ontic states you can use to represent a qubit, if you want it to represent everything in general, like transformations and so on, the most ontic states you can have is 4, which is obviously a really restrictive condition. So in order to represent kind of a fully compositional model of a qubit, you have very constrained structure. Even just the number of ontic states is very constrained, not to mention that you also have to satisfy all of these other precise mathematical features. And this is a powerful tool for studying non-contextuality. Just to give you an example of how easy it is to use this tool, anytime you have a proof that you need more than 4 ontic states for a qubit, such as Lucy and Hardy's excess baggage theorem, you can immediately use that to conclude that there must be some contextuality in that scenario. Or if you take some particular model that somebody has proposed, like the 8-state model by Wolman and Bartlett for stabilizer qubits, you know immediately that when applied, at least when applied to transformations, it's contextual. And a third example of how this structure theorem can be useful is, let's now apply it to the stabilizer subtheory. So I don't need to say much about the stabilizer subtheory to this particular audience, but I'll just remind you that it can be implemented fault tolerantly. But if you want to promote it to universality, you have to inject some non-stabilizer states or processes. And this leads to the state injection model for quantum computation, where you try to use some resource states and inject them into the stabilizer stuff, which is kind of considered free and easy to implement. And this leads to a model for universal quantum computation, which, as I understand it, is one of the leading models. So what is this stabilizer subtheory I'm talking about? Again, I'll go pretty quickly for this audience. So you start with some basis. Let's take the computational basis on some system of dimension D and define the dth root of unity here as omega. Then you can define a position translation on this basis, which acts as follows on the computational basis. A momentum translation operation, which just acts as follows on the computational basis. It just induces this phase proportional to x. And then from these position and momentum translations, you can define the Weyl operators, which are just products of these kind of generalized Pauli operators. So you take the x operator to the q power and the z operator to the p power. Sometimes people put a phase out front, but here this is the convention I'm going to use, where p and q are integers mod d. And then from these Weyl operators, we can define the stabilizer subtheory. Just to define the states, we just take eigenstates of these Weyl operators. For measurements, we take projective measurements in the eigenbases of these Weyl operators. And for transformations, the allowed transformations are called Clifford unitaries. And they're the unitaries that preserve the Weyl operators, by which I mean, if you conjugate a Weyl operator by U and U dagger like this, you get another Weyl operator up to some proportionality. So if you define everything like that, then you get a nice, elegant, closed subtheory of quantum mechanics. It's closed under composition. And this is known as the stabilizer subtheory for that dimension. Okay, so now let's talk about representations of this part of quantum theory. So there's a well-known representation that I've alluded to several times already, which was first invented by David Gross. And the nice thing is that his representation is a linear diagram preserving representation, which means it has to have the form that I told you earlier, which means I can specify the entire representation just by giving you the definition of some basis, a non-overcomplete basis of Hermitian operators. And here's how they're defined. So first we take the indices of these operators to be P and Q, defined as before. And then we define the operator A indexed by P and Q by this particular linear combination of the Weyl operators. And from this basis, you can compute everything else. So these are called the phase space point operators in this basis. And from them, you can, so now we can have a kind of phase space representation where Q and P are both three valued things for the case of a qutrit. So here's what the phase space looks like. There's kind of 9 ontic states, if you like, in this representation. And we can look at what the representation of states are. So as I mentioned, you just take the trace of a given state with these operators. And if that state is one of the stabilizer states, then you can show that these objects are valid probability distributions. So So in general, on a general state, this mapping will take you to a vector of possibly negative numbers. But for the stabilizer state specifically, whether it be on a single system or on multiple systems, whether you have product states or in this case here an entangled state, you get a valid probability distribution. So you have a representation of your stabilizer states as a probability distribution over this kind of phase space. You can also represent the unitaries in the stabilizer subtheory. Again, just using the prescription I gave earlier. When you do that, what you find are some permutations on phase space. So these are valid stochastic processes. Moreover, in fact, they're symplectic permutations. So they have even more structure, but the point for our purposes is this quasi-probability representation is everywhere positive. And so at the end of all this, we get a positive representation of the entire stabilizer subtheory for odd dimensions. And we can go further using that structure theorem that I mentioned. So as we show in this paper, from that structure theorem, we can show that not only is Gross's representation a positive representation, but it's the only positive representation. In all odd dimensions, every stabilizer subtheory has a unique positive quasi-probability representation, namely Gross's. And equivalently, there's a unique non-contextual model for this. And I'll just point out that Speckens toy theory is equivalent to Gross's representation, if you're familiar with that. So in odd dimensions, so in these odd dimensions, these objects are the unique representation, classical representation. Now, I've said in odd dimensions, there's some kind of weird numerology going on that I've never understood deeply, where in even dimensions, the stabilizer subtheory actually has a quite different character. And in fact, again, using this structure theorem, you can show that there's no positive quasi-probability representation for any even dimensional stabilizer subtheory. So equivalently, even dimensional stabilizer subtheories are always non-classical. It was well known that the qubit stabilizer subtheory had contextuality, but this result kind of extends that to arbitrary even dimensional stabilizer subtheories. Okay, so there's a unique classical explanation of the stabilizer subtheory, which if you remember how Barba defined non-contextuality, it's kind of shocking. It's this very kind of broad-seeming notion that you have this large scope of possible non-contextual models, but somehow when you have all the rich structure of the stabilizer subtheory, it's sufficient to single out a single possible classical model. So that's kind of interesting. And moreover, it lets us now understand better why negativity in Gross's representation is useful for quantum computation. Because against the backdrop of the odd dimensional stabilizer subtheory, negativity of a process in Gross's representation implies non-classicality. That's the new thing. So if you give me the entire stabilizer subtheory plus some process, which happens to be represented negatively in Gross's representation, then you know there's no other representation which could conceivably represent all that stuff positively. So you have a proof of contextuality, a proof of non-classicality. Now, I should point out that there was already some kind of special features of Gross's representation that were known. Namely, Gross proved that his representation was the only one among some larger family of representations, the Gibbons-Hoffman-Wouter representations, which satisfied an elegant mathematical property of Clifford covariance. But there's a number of advantages of our uniqueness result over Gross's. Most importantly, generalized non-contextuality is a notion of classicality. It's sort of independently motivated in the foundational literature. It's not just like an elegant mathematical feature like covariance. Moreover, Gross's result required two ad hoc mathematical assumptions. Namely, he starts from the assumption that the kind of space over which you have probability distributions is a D by D phase space. And he starts with an assumption that certain marginals have a certain flavor. And neither of those is necessary in our approach. We derive these facts from the structure theorem that I mentioned earlier. We don't put them in as assumptions. And moreover, Gross's uniqueness result only holds for odd prime dimensions, whereas ours holds for all odd dimensions. And I should point out that there were similar kind of uniqueness results proved by Zhu, but these comments that apply to Gross's representation apply essentially the same way to Zhu's arguments. So this explains now the demonstrated usefulness of Gross's representation in studying quantum computation. So as I mentioned, we now have a mathematical connection between negativity and Gross's representation and contextuality. And then we can use the other known connections between negativity and computation to get connections between contextuality and computation. So let's do that. Namely, what's pretty well known is that any state which promotes the stabilizer subtheory to universal quantum computation has to have negativity in Gross's representation. And Howard et al. Showed that negativity implies Koch and Specker contextuality. We showed that it implies generalized contextuality. So you can combine either of these results together with this fact to conclude that generalized contextuality, like Koch and Specker contextuality, is necessary for universal quantum computation in this particular state injection model with the stabilizer subtheory. Now, this raises the natural question, is generalized contextuality sufficient for computation? We've just argued that it's necessary, at least in this model. Well, it's obviously not sufficient without some further caveats, because the even dimensional stabilizer subtheories are efficiently simulable, right? That was the Gottesman-Knill theorem. But we also said earlier in this talk that every even dimensional stabilizer subtheory has contextuality. So contextuality can't be sufficient, but I think many people have the idea that if you were to go more than just say existence of contextuality and ask about certain measures of contextuality, what if you have a lot of contextuality? Maybe that's sufficient. Or maybe if the contextuality scales with the size of the circuit in some particular way, then that would be sufficient. Or something along these lines, some more refined statement of what kind of contextuality, how much contextuality might be sufficient for computation. That's a very interesting question that many of us have been thinking about for some time. So that's everything I have time to talk about. Thanks very much for your attention, and I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you, David. Questions from the audience here? Yes, Robert, can I talk to you?
Hello, still operational, good. Okay, so I have a question about this model by Bartlett and company that you mentioned, the one qubit model. So you could think of quantum computation with magic state, with a single qubit magic state using that model, and everything would be, I mean, silly computation, but still you could think of it, everything would be positively represented. The magic state and the Clifford gates and the Pauli measurements, everything would be positive. So negativity is absent in that model, and some would say, oh yeah, that looks classical. But I guess you would call it non-classical because I guess the magic state has preparation contextuality in that model. It's not uniquely represented. If that is correct in a correct assertion of what you would say, why is this feature of non-unique representation more important than the absence of negativity? I mean, some would say, oh, there's no negativity, so it's effectively classical. You say, no, it's non-classical because this non-uniqueness of representation. If that is your point of view, can you please explain why that feature of non-unique representation is so important?
Yeah, so there's a number of ways in which a given model can fail to be sort of this, fail to be an ontological model of quantum theory, or fail to satisfy, fail to be a non-contextual ontological model of quantum theory as an operational theory. So you could take, so I kind of forget whether the eight-state model of Bartlett and Wolman was I don't think it was even defined for general, like for all of quantum theory. It might have only been defined for states and effects. I'm not sure. Maybe they also defined it for transformations, but it certainly wasn't defined in a fully general way for like arbitrary compositional theories. And if you want to extend it to be fully compositional, there's a number of things you could do. You could either have it not be a representation of the quantum processes as quantum channels, quantum states, and quantum effects, but merely of, you know, you could take the representation to depend on specific context information, like whether your channel was implemented by some particular mixture of unitaries or some other particular mixture of unitaries. If you allow that kind of context dependence, then it's no longer a representation of quantum theory as a GPT or kind of the standard formalism of quantum theory, but rather of quantum theory as an unquotiented operational theory. And it's that kind of dependence, which is kind of explicitly a contextual model. It's dependence of the representation on context. And then to see why I would personally call that non-classical, that's when you start talking about Leibniz's principle and the motivations we have for non-contextuality. But there are other ways of extending this representation to all of quantum theory. So that way would force you to have contextuality, but the advantage of it, which you seem to be interested in, is that it would be everywhere positive. So it is an advantage that it's positive, but the disadvantage is that it has explicit contextuality. There's other ways of where you could keep the kind of non-contextual flavor in it, by which I mean you could continue to have a map of quantum theory in the usual sense as the quotiented theory, like where you don't depend on this extra context information, but then you're forced to input negativity or imaginarity or other kinds of problematic features. But if you want a model which both has no context dependence and is positive everywhere, that's the thing that's difficult. It's quite easy to if you're willing to give up any one of these features, it's quite easy to make models that are just positive everywhere. Like Barbara said, it's pretty much always been known that you can have an ontological model which is positive everywhere. It gives you a kind of stochastic representation of not just quantum theory, but of any theory, if you don't demand any further constraints like non-contextuality. So then to motivate that, as I said, we'd have to discuss the motivations for the particular features that we think are interesting, like non-contextuality.
Good for now. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the question.
Other questions from the audience? Yes, can you pass it on?
Okay. You made the claim early on that you think that the proper notion of non-classicality when talking about computation is generalized contextuality. But if you want to make that claim, it seems like the stabilizer subtheory in even dimensions is a real problem because, as you said, it's classically simulable, but you would say it's also contextual. So you mentioned this a bit at the end, but could you instead say that there isn't really a single unique notion of non-classicality that's applicable in every setting, and in different settings it makes sense to talk about different notions of non-classicality?
Sure, yeah, that's a good question. So as I mentioned here, and as you're alluding to as well, we know that kind of efficient simulability does not coincide with non-contextuality because of these examples like the even dimensional stabilizer subtheories. And I think that's interesting. As I said, I think there might still be tight connections between contextuality and computational advantage, but I don't think there's any reason why you'd expect some kind of foundational notion of classicality, which, remember, it applies across all physics, right? It's not somehow designed for computation. The question of efficient simulability is, of course, you know, the most natural in the setting of quantum computation. To a computer scientist, efficient simulability is going to be, you know, a question of central interest. And if you're comparing what have been called classical computers to quantum computers, then you might call that a notion of classicality. But here we're looking for a notion of classicality that makes sense, not just for computation, but across all of physics, including computation, but not specific to it. So it's kind of the opposite, I would say. It would be a miracle. In fact, it would be almost problematic if we found that sort of every instance of non-classicality in all of physics was useful for computation. I mean, that would feel like, you know, we arose in a universe that was somehow built for us specifically to do computation. You know, like there's many other tasks like communication, which have nothing to do with efficient simulability per se, and which we still want notions of classicality that are relevant for, you know, teleportation or dense coding or just some simple prepare and measure experiment involving many body physics or something. So there's just no reason why such a broad notion of classicality would always imply what would be generically sufficient for computational speedups. So that's why I think it's not surprising. It's inevitable that a well-motivated notion of classicality won't be just literally necessary and sufficient for simulability without these more nuanced considerations. But I think that's a long-winded way of me agreeing with you that, you know, in different contexts, when you focus specifically on simulability, you know, quantum speedups over classical computers and so on, then of course, kind of the question of quantum speedups is a natural question there. But I don't think it would make sense to kind of co-opt the word classicality as a broad thing that's meant to apply to any area of physics to be efficient simulability. Whereas I think you can reasonably argue that the notion of classicality or the term classicality that's motivated by Leibniz's principle can be applied in sort of any area of physics. I don't think it, but because the principle is this broad principle about theory building, it really does apply to kind of any area of physics that you want to be building a theory. But still there are, when you specialize, there will be specialized notions of classicality that might be more interesting or that you might want to check the connections with this broad notion.
Okay, so in the interest of time, we're running a bit late. Let's thank David again.
Thank you very much.